The 40-point intake readiness scoring grid is made up of 7 key considerations that fall on your front office. And these are, number 1, the number of times the phone rings before it's picked up. Believe it or not, patients make some conclusions and observations about that. Number 2, reception staff per monthly new patient. That is a ratio. Number 3, years of experience of your main telephone operator. Number 4, verbal skills training for the person answering the phone. Number 5, hours that the phone is live answered as opposed to with a machine or a service. Number 6, receptionist on an incentive. That is an incentive to get these people through the door. Number 7, schedule availability, or how long a patient has to wait to become a new patient. Let's go back to number 1 for a second. Let's do it as an example. If the phone only rings once before it's answered, we give you 5 points. See, each of the 7 areas mentioned can win a total of 5 points, with the exception of the last one, scheduling availability. And that one's more heavily weighted than the others. We award 10 points instead of 5 for the maximum score on scheduling availability. All right, let's go ahead and score your practice for intake readiness. Number 1, the number of times the phone rings before it's picked up. If it rings only once, on average, we give you 5 points. Twice, you get 4 points. 3 times, 3 points. 4 times, 2 points. 5 times, 1 point. And if it's beyond 5 times, we don't give you any points. Next, reception staff per new patient. If it's 1 staff person per 12 to 15 new patients, we give you 5 points. That's good. If it's 1 per 15 to 20, we give you 4 points. 1 per 20 to 25, 2 points. 1 per 25 to 30, 1 point. And if it's beyond that, we don't give you any points. All right, next, years of experience of staff answering the phone. If it's under 3 months, you get 1 point. If it's 3 to 6 months, 2 points. 7 to 12 months, 3 points. 13 to 18 months, 4 points. And if they have 19 to 24 months, that's 2 years, it's 5 points. Next, verbal skill training. If they've been professionally trained by Jay Geyer, we give you 5 points. If they've been trained by other staff, we give you 3 points. If there's been no verbal training, that is formal verbal training by anyone, 0. Next, hours per week that the phone is live answered. That is, it's answered by a member of your team. If it's 48 hours, we give you 5 points. 40 hours a week, 4 points. 32 to 40, 3 points. 24 to 32, 2 points. If your phone is live answered, 18 hours to 24 hours, we give you 1 point. If it's under 18 hours, you get nothing. Next, is your receptionist on an incentive? The answer is no, you get 0 points. If the answer is yes, but she doesn't seem to be motivated by it, you get 1 point. If it's, oh yeah, she's really motivated, you get 5 points. Next, scheduling availability. If the person has to wait 5 days, that is a new patient, has to wait 5 days to get into the practice, you get 1 point. 4 days, 2 points. 3 days, 4 points. 2 days, 6 points. 1 day, 8 points. And if you can get a patient in today, that is a new patient, you get 10 points. All right, let's add up your score and see how you did. Number of rings, reception staff to new patient ratio, years experience, verbal skill training, hours per week the phone's live answered, receptionist on incentive, and scheduling availability. Let's take a look at your score. So how did you do? I know you're wondering if you got a good score. Well, there are no good scores or bad scores, unless, of course, you're about to advertise. And then there's some very good and some very bad scores. Those of you who have mailed with us at Whitehall using our direct mailing program, you already know that we don't encourage you to mail unless you have an intake readiness score of 25 or above, and you have to maintain that score during the time you're using our mailers. All right, let's go on. Once you have ad scores totaled up and intake readiness scores done, you're ready for the final step. It's what we call the Marketing Viability Index calculation. This index puts it all together and tells you if you're a good candidate to benefit from paid advertising. Here's how the index works. You take your ad scores and you combine them with your intake readiness scores. This gives you a total possible of 100. You then multiply this number times the average monthly referrals you're getting. We call this your referral intensity score. All right, let's take an example. Let's take a practice with an ad score of 20, an intake readiness score of 15. This gives them a combination of 35. We're going to multiply 35 times the number of direct monthly referrals to the practice. In this case, it's going to be 10. As you already know, we push for 40 as the ideal. This doctor is going to have a marketing viability index of 350. That's 20 for the ad scores, plus 15 or 35 total, times 10 referrals. That's 350 is their marketing viability index. I might add that this is a low score when you consider that 4,000 would normally be considered possible. That would be 100, that's 40 for the intake readiness plus 60 for the ads multiplied times 40 new patients or 40 referrals would be a total possible of 4,000. All right, that's your marketing viability index. But unfortunately, it really doesn't end there. Your marketing viability index score is relative. Relative to what, you say? It's relative to the other doctors in the area. It's relative to the competition. We call this, then, the competitive challenge ratio. This refers to the number of doctors as well as the advertisers that you might be competing with in your drawing area. For example, an ad that works well in an area with 2,000 prospective patients per doctor might fail miserably in an area that has only 600 prospective patients per doctor. When we're asked to do forensic marketing analysis, in other words, to try to determine why an ad didn't work, we often find that there's an overwhelming competitive challenge ratio. I've seen doctors living in the middle of nowhere who thought they were marketing geniuses. They then move to a highly competitive area only to find that none of their proven ads work. I tell you all of this in an effort to prepare you to participate in paid advertising. You see, it's not just as easy as grabbing an ad and getting out there. With the Whitehall mailing program, we have strict rules about who can use the mailers. First, the doctor has to already be getting 15 direct patient referrals per month. Second, they have to have an intake readiness score of at least 25 out of the possible 40. That means that their front desk is ready for the marginal patient that comes from advertising. Remember, advertising only generates leads. Third, they have to have additional and verifiable peak time capacity. That means that they have enough space, equipment, staff, and that the doctor is fast enough that during the busy times of the day, that is the times a lot of patients want to come in, they can comfortably add more patients, especially more new patients. A lot of doctors make that mistake. They think that they can squeeze new patients away from the high demand times since the patient's new to the practice. Not so. You will lose new patients because many of them are convenience shoppers as well as price shoppers. All right, fourth, our doctors have to have listened to the Jay Geyer CD that we did, and they have to listen to it with their staff. We prefer that they actually put their team through Jay's training, but that is optional. And fifth, we insist that they send a team leader to the Whitehall Team Leader Training Program. At this training, team leaders are taught to spot hidden capacity blockages and ensure that the practice has been consumerized, or referralized, as we say here at Whitehall. In fact, anyone using our mailers is welcome to send a team leader to the Whitehall Team Leader Training Camp at no charge. We're that committed to this concept. A lot of doctors have asked us why we chose mailers as our main advertising strategy. There's so many different media out there. Why mailers? It's because they stand alone in their ability to bring patients to the practice. Things like billboards, radio, television, they often require additional print media like newspaper and mail to actually generate the new patient phone calls from the billboards and the radio. In other words, those aren't enough. They have to be worked together in a coordinated campaign to make them even pay. In other words, if you're just going to put your financial toe in the advertising water, mail is the most cost-effective way to go. We began offering mailers back when doctors started complaining that some of the better mailing programs out there sold exclusive rights to the areas and that someone else had already claimed their drawing area. The Whitehall mailers are only exclusive in the nature of the campaign chosen. In other words, another Whitehall doctor could be mailing in your area, but they would not be mailing the same mailing piece or dropping it at the same time. I personally like mailing pieces because you have a large enough area to achieve a full 60-point ad score. And speaking of ad scores, I might mention that if you are ever forced to design your own ad and you have to fit it into a small ad space, try to get as many 5-point ad components as possible into that ad. For example, a small ad with a compelling benefit headline matched with a powerful introductory offer. It can bring in more new patients than a large ad with a weak offer and a lifeless headline. If you do meet the requirements to use the Whitehall mailers and you feel your practice qualifies under one of those 5 viable mailing scenarios that we talked about, remember, if you have extra capacity, etc., if that's the case, then you're welcome to participate. Our printer has seen the value of working with the Whitehall doctors. He's offering our clients a price that represents buying power of literally hundreds of practices combined. I told him I wanted a price for our clients that was so low they couldn't even come close to matching it if they were going to try printing these mailers on their own. I'd go so far with this that I'd say you're actually welcome to try. If you can print and mail our mailing pieces cheaper on your own, you have our permission to use them and to do it without paying us. Under our program, you can print and mail as few as 5,000 pieces per month, and there's no commitment. Most programs require that you print 50,000 or more to begin, and you have to pay for those up front. And that's right, with our program, you can quit anytime you want. We put this program together from the perspective of how we would want to do it if we were in the doctor's position. And we've assembled enough high-powered mailing campaigns that more than one doctor can use them in the same area without having a duplication. You're going to want to change your campaign every 6 to 9 months anyway to keep it fresh. Our printer promises to get your mailers out within 2 weeks from the time you've chosen your offer, given your personal information for the printed piece. Now, I'm not trying to sell you on mailing. For those of you who have listened to our previous recordings, you already know we're very strong on having a referral-driven practice. But if you do end up wanting to or needing to mail, we've put together a program that's more powerful, more flexible, and more affordable than any you're going to find in the industry. So if you want to mail with us, just call Kim at Whitehall. All right, let's go on to our next question. This one's financial. My broker is suggesting that I cash in my municipal bonds because he says that they're now more valuable than when I purchased them 8 years ago. Doctor, not having access to your entire financial picture, I would hesitate to accuse your broker of wrongdoing. But here's the problem. You can sell older bonds and make a profit doing it. The problem is that when you go to reinvest your profits, you're going to be offered a lower, unattractive yield that's available in the current marketplace. And yes, it's exactly proportional. You're going to lose as much on the new interest as you're going to gain from the resale profit. It's a perfect, efficient market out there. That's why we've always said that you can't trade your way to a better yield. Yes, you can make a profit, but you cannot improve your position in the marketplace. Doctor, it's really all about yield. Remember, I said you can't trade your way to a better yield. See, yield takes into account both principal and the coupon or stated interest rate. So that really brings up the question, is there ever a case for bond trading? That is there ever a good case? I would say yes. For example, let's say you have financial needs that call for immediate cash, and you could sell some of your bonds for a profit. Well, then by all means, sell. But if you're being encouraged to trade for the sake of interest rate or principal improvement, then you're in questionable territory. All right, next question. Greg, with real estate so hot, I'm thinking of borrowing on my house to purchase some investment properties. How do you feel about this type of borrowing? Well, Doctor, I'm starting to wonder if you know me very well. It's not that I'm really just against borrowing. It's the purpose of the borrowing that's questionable here. Let me explain. For example, if you want to borrow on your house to consolidate debt to lower your monthly payments or to reduce your interest rate, well, that's not so bad. The move you've described in your question to Whitehall involves significant market risk. Market risk refers to the investment risk associated with a specific equity market. You may remember some of the early Whitehall audio programs that talked about investment risk. The problem with equity type investments is that to make money, you have to eventually sell them. In fact, you have to sell them in an improved market, meaning that there has to be an improved ratio of buyers to sellers at some future date for this asset, in this case, real estate. And there's the problem. What is there that you can predict the future ratio of buyers to sellers for? I say there's nothing that fits that category. People always point to some investment that's either gone up consistently in their, recent memory or that should logically go up consistently. In retrospect, you see, it all comes down to timing. If you're going to park money, and in this case, borrowed money, into an equity investment, you're going to have to know when to withdraw that as well as when to invest it. See, real estate falls into that logical category of equity investment. That means that it, by all rights, it should go up and that it should do so consistently. Now, it becomes a little circular here because one of the reasons that it should go up is because it always has gone up. In the case of real estate, yes, it's always gone up since the Great Depression. But unfortunately, it's only gone up consistently at the national level. See, you, on the other hand, won't be buying national real estate. You're going to be buying an apartment building or a fixer-upper house across town. You see, real estate has only been a predictable investment if you consider the nation as a whole. When you consider the various regional real estate markets, there has been tremendous volatility. That's right, when one sector is in decline, the increase in an adjacent market has kept the national picture rosy. You know, I think of Southern California as the epicenter of real estate craziness. In a December 2, 2002 CNN print article by staff writer Leslie Hagan Geary, she says Southern California housing prices fell a whopping 21% between 1989 and 1996. And those of you who have followed California real estate know that it just doesn't get any more volatile. The article goes on to point out that another mythically invulnerable real estate market, namely Honolulu, their real estate prices lost 19% of their value between 1995 and 1999. The article concludes by saying, "People tell you that housing never goes down, but that's just not true, especially when you try to sell your house when interest rates have gone up." And Doctor, keep the whole concept of leverage in mind. Remember, leverage is the process of controlling a large asset with a small investment. For example, you purchase a $500,000 home with $10,000 down, and then you have a $490,000 mortgage. If the home quickly increases in value by, say, $100,000, you've earned 10 times your original cash investment. Maybe that happened in 6 months or a year. See, that's leverage. What people forget is that it can also work in reverse. That's right. If you see the same home quickly plunge $100,000 in value, you've lost 10 times your cash investment. And to make matters worse, you've got to pay a mortgage payment on the money that you now have lost. If I were asked to project my best guess on the real estate market, I would say that as long as interest rates hold, there may be a little life left in the market. So, Doctor, I would say yes to borrowing, but for the right reason, and yes to real estate investing, but not yes to both at the same time the way you have applied them. In other words, if you want to borrow on your home for a legitimate reason, like the ones that we just mentioned, then okay. If you want to invest in real estate with cash, then yes. But to borrow on your home to invest in an equity investment, one where you have to predict the future ratio of buyers to sellers? Then no. Don't even think about it. It's just too risky. Remember the Whitehall premise. That is, because you have a great income, and most doctors do, all you have to do is even save the smallest portion over your lifetime and know you're going to be rich. That's right. All you have to do is not make any serious financial mistakes, and you're going to do just fine. You're going to hear people tell you that because you're young, you should be a more aggressive investor. The logic being that because you are young, you have many years to correct for an investment mistake. To me, the fallacy in that line of thought is that if you really are young and you have decades ahead of you left to earn money and invest, then by my estimation, you don't have to take any risk. If you have enough years to compound your money, you could put it all in a passbook savings account at your local bank branch and you'd be just fine. I've also heard the argument presented that if you're an older person, well, you don't have much time left and you have to invest more aggressively. You don't have any choice. This argument is especially compelling to an older doctor who feels they haven't done well at accumulating retirement funds. To me, this makes no more sense than the "you're young, so go for it" investment rationale. If you really are old and underfunded, you need to avoid risk at all cost. We found that if a doctor will simply save their age, they end up just fine. That means if you're 45 years old, you need to be saving $45,000 a year after tax. And that would mean that next year, unless you're skipping birthdays, as some of us do, you'd have to save $46,000 after tax, and so on. See, this even works for the doctor who starts out with nothing saved at age 65. As long as they could save $65,000 that year, and so on, they're going to end up with far more money saved than the doctor who starts saving at a young age who invests too aggressively. Don't let anyone intimidate you into investing beyond your own investment risk threshold. So be careful.